in the UK's very, very hands-off liberal approach to vaping, because I argued that in behavioural terms, giving up smoking is very, very hard. The invention of e-cigarettes was a watershed moment in people quitting smoking. I've come to the conclusion that actually, once more than a certain percentage of your life becomes political, you go mad. I'm not even sure politics should be a full-time job. Whatever your politics are, you should actually make the point of saying, actually, I lean right of centre, but I'm pretty left-wing about this. One of the greatest things I've done in the last few years, which I recommend to everybody, is YouTube Premium. First of all, when you have ad-free YouTube, it becomes unbelievably useful because, as I said, YouTube hit this tipping point where it's now become Wikipedia with video. If one particular AI predominates in the world, that's problematic. Much more problematic than just having one Google. Stuart Butterfield, the founder of Slack, said this. You know, there's no meaningful measure of innovation other than behavioral change. If we're not changing how people behave, we're not really meaningfully innovating.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Fantastic to see you. Excellent.
How's the weather currently in UK?
The UK, it's a bit crap, actually. I've just got back from a place called Fuerteventura, which is an island in the Canary Islands. I got back on Wednesday. And so it's a bit of a curse being back. Because as my father says, the three worst things about living in Britain are January, February and March. It's not really that it's really cold. It's not viciously cold. It's, you know, it has been quite wet, but it's just dark all the time. That's the real problem. It's starting to get lighter now, but sort of January and February, you know, you spend most of your life in the dark, which is a bit depressing.
How do you think the weather in UK correlates to people's personalities and moods there?
That's an interesting question. And obviously, weather has a huge effect on behaviour and, to some extent, temperament, for obvious reasons. It's worth noting, actually, the UK has an upside. It's very rarely it's very rarely oppressively hot. It's very rarely dangerously cold. And the other upside you have is in the summer, you get very, very late evenings. So it stays light until kind of 10 o'clock at night, 10:30, which is actually, in many ways, very, very nice. But there is, I think, seasonal affective disorder or whatever. I think Brits do get down in the winter the same way that Scandinavians probably do. The summers, I have to say, are great. I mean, I partly went to Fuerteventura is that I've started realising that there's a huge payoff to going on holiday in the winter, somewhere a bit warmer. Whereas, to be honest, if you go somewhere in July or August, well, it's getting to a point now where you exchange really nice weather for weather which is too hot if you're not careful. You know, you can end up in the south of Spain or something in a heat wave and you'd wish you'd stayed at home. There are all kinds of kind of weird divides between Northern Europe and Southern Europe, I think, in temperament. And having said that, it's not... I'll give you an example. What I've never understood is that New Yorkers think that London has a bad climate. And my argument is there, well, yes, it rains a bit more often. Actually, I'm not sure it does rain more often. It rains more in Dallas than it does in London. I think it rains more in Rome than it does in London as well, actually. So the actual rainfall isn't the problem. It's that it's damp quite a lot of the time. It's not really heavy rain. It's just dampness. That's the one problem. But having said that, New Yorkers sort of attack London for its climate. But then if you go to New York in parts of the summer, it's uninhabitably hot and smells of wee, which New Yorkers don't seem to notice. You're in Sydney, presumably. And I've also been in New York in the winter where it's just agonizingly cold. And we don't get that. But you're Sydney, are you?
Correct. Yes. Sydney, Australia.
Which is, I think, it's as close to the best city in the world. I mean, the cities that I find absolutely amazing would be, I wouldn't include London, because if you grow up with the place, it's not that special. But Sydney has that extraordinary thing where if there were nothing built there, it would be an unbelievably beautiful bay. And if it were just a city on the middle of a plain, it would be a really impressive city. But you've actually combined the two. Chicago, I think, is like that. Chicago is another city, I think, is obviously the climate there in the winter is pretty grim, but I think Chicago is an absolutely magnificent city. Rome, I think, is fantastic. Well, Hong Kong, I think, is just remarkable. And I've never been to Melbourne. I've always planned to go. Sydney, I think, is absolutely remarkable. I find it just captivatingly lovely as a city. And yeah, as I said, Chicago is probably my favorite big US city, partly because if you're a Brit, this is me being really harsh, but I always think Boston or New York or San Francisco are, in a way, okay, they're trying to be European cities, and in some ways they're better, but in some ways they're a lot worse. Whereas Chicago, for example, is just a uniquely American city, or LA for that matter. But it, as a Brit, you go there and you go, well, this is completely different. This is amazing. And but Chicago architecturally also is, and as with Sydney, I think, is just really, really fabulous.
Rory, at the moment, are you traveling for events, talking events? Are you traveling for work? What gets you around the world currently?
I mean, a lot of my travel has been sort of event related or speaking related, and in a way, I'm grateful for it. In some ways, I'm not grateful for it, because you do, in some cases, you end up going somewhere fabulous and then staying for 24 hours. I'll just find, just wait one second. My apologies. I'm incredibly sorry about that, but it was quite important, which is I woke up this morning to see a police car in our garden, and the police are here to recover a stolen vehicle, because we've increasingly noticed. When I say our garden, I live in a sort of apartment, and there are about seven of us living in this building. But we've increasingly noticed some really weird and suspicious behaviour, with people sort of driving in and out in a strange way, and so on. And we were just wondering what was going on, because occasionally a car would appear here, which we didn't recognise, and then disappear about a day later. And this time the police have been down to collect a car that was stolen last night, and where they couldn't remove the tracker, so they just dumped the car here. We've obviously got some sort of strange, nefarious activity going on outside.
One thing I found interesting is that all these countries with super high tax, like California as a state, they seem to be the most dangerous countries or places, and countries with super low tax, like Dubai, apparently has the lowest crime rates, and it seems contrary, opposite.
I mean, it's a dangerous thing to correlate, because there are countries. If you have a country which is, very dishonest, what happens is that regardless of the tax rate, a hell of a lot of people don't actually pay tax. And in defense of the UK, most people, if you exclude sort of the tax avoidance practiced by the very rich, most people do pay their tax. So people do actually pay up. That's an interesting question. I mean, it's worth noting that, Dubai and the Middle Eastern countries also achieve a very low crime rate on the basis of extremely strict punishment. The United States seems to manage to have extremely strict punishment and a huge rate of incarceration, combined with quite a high rate of crime. I think, I'm not sure that the US, I think China and Russia would be the only ones close, I think. But I think the US may have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, which is that the highest percentage of its population are actually in prison at any given time. And yet, it doesn't seem to be working brilliantly in some cases in terms of the crime rate. Although you could argue, actually, there are some elements. It's bad for violent crime, the US. But for example, domestic burglary and domestic break-in, partly because you might have a gun, you're less likely to have your house broken into in the US mostly than you are in the UK. And that probably is a benefit. It's, if you can call it a benefit, it's a feature of high gun ownership. In that, in Texas, what are the odds that the guy is packing some heat? Well, it's well over 50%, I would have thought. So you're not going to take that risk of breaking into someone's house.
Yeah, I don't know if it was because of the story you just shared, but when you talked about that car incident outside your road, I don't know if it's social media, but I've been fed a lot of this content about how UK is very unsafe. There's a lot of stabbings, a lot of.
No, that's not a fair depiction. There are parts of London which have And particularly London, but other large cities where the incidence of knife crime has grown. It's mostly, I would say, gang crime, which is crook on crook. But there are obviously, innocent bystanders. But it'd be unfair to depict the UK as being dangerous. I mean, for example, people have started talking about, oh, there are no-go areas in London. Well, there are dangerous areas in London. There are areas where I probably wouldn't go after dark. I wouldn't leave my car parked there, not for very long. But there aren't, those things are often an exaggeration. The crime rate in London particularly has gone up in certain forms of crime, but it wouldn't be fair by comparison with, say, South Africa or the United States, and by which I mean the dangerous parts of the United States. It wouldn't be fair to depict the UK as crime-ridden. Some of this is also reporting, probably, but there has been a big sort of growth in knife crime in London. But I don't go into London. I'm probably frightened of being pickpocketed, but I don't go into London, consciously and constantly alert to the threat of violence. That wouldn't be a fair depiction. I can't speak for everybody else, of course, because your level of fear is your own affair. It's not really people's level of fear isn't really based on statistics. To take an example, one of the reasons Japanese tourists tend to go around in groups is that compared to Japan, the crime rate almost everywhere is incredibly high. So, Japanese tourists might see London the way we would have seen sort of New York in the 1970s or something, as just impossibly dangerous and you need to be accompanied. And again, your level of fear and anxiety is calibrated by all kinds of things. And actually, it's not really based on statistics. It's based on news stories, which is what one interesting question. I mean, there's an interesting question, which is whether the news, rather, you mentioned the weather, but I wonder to the extent to which relentlessly negative news coverage is actually, well, depressing people and destroying optimism to a point where it's actually economically dangerous.
Yeah, like I was wondering, like, how does the news corporations benefit financially from purporting a bunch of fear, crime? Does that even increase watch time? I'd expect people to get off it.
The interesting thing is that two things that seem to be really reliable at garnering attention are basically fear and anger. And this is, several people have kind of resigned from Facebook over this because they realize that what their algorithm is optimized for is maximizing attention. Now, there are perfectly sound evolutionary reasons why we disproportionately focus on things which are potentially threatening or really, really annoying. I mean, at a very simple level, I'm sitting here. If I hear a conversation outside the window, which is two people discussing the weather or having an amicable conversation, I'm not remotely interested. If I hear an argument, I'll go and press my nose against the glass because, in evolutionary terms, it pays us to pay attention to negative things. Disproportionately, we're calibrated, rather like your smoke detector is calibrated to go off rather too often, because a false positive when you make toast is a lot less serious in its consequences than a false negative, okay, which is your house catching fire while you're asleep and the fire alarm going, it's probably nothing. So, smoke detectors are calibrated to be paranoid because as I said, the false positive is not particularly serious, whereas a false negative is potentially a cause to exit the gene pool. And in the same way, because of that, any kind of news algorithm which is optimized around attention will upweight the negative because we like good news stories, but we're compulsively drawn to bad news stories. And I think it I particularly worry about the effect on younger people as well, because when you're young, if anything, you should be slightly too optimistic. One of the benefits of young people is that they're slightly less risk averse, they're slightly more optimistic, perhaps they're slightly more self-deluded, but that's the stage in your life where you want that. It pays to become increasingly cautious as you get older when you have, in a sense, more to lose. And I would worry about the extent to which young people are convinced they're living in the worst world ever. Okay. When in, I know there are people who I imagine are living, but for most young people in a developed country, with the single except, it's a few exceptions like ridiculous price of property, so on. But you could reasonably say of most young people, you've never had it so good in terms of their access to travel, comforts, consumer goods, and entertainment, interest, and so on. I mean, it's very interesting because I was born in 1965, and I think I was part of the last generation kind of thing who remember being really bored. I now maybe that was really good for us. But I don't remember my own kids. My own kids were born in 2001. I don't really, they might get depressed a bit, but I don't really remember them going, I've got nothing to do, I'm bored. And I can remember, not saying that my entire childhood was just, long, long hours of relentless tedium. I'm not going that far, but there were long periods where you go, I'm just bored now. I can't think of anything to do, and that seems to happen, less and less. But also in all manner of fields. I mean, I didn't fly anywhere long haul until I was about 20, what was 93, 28. So I didn't cross the Atlantic or go anywhere long haul until I was 28. I probably only flew twice between the age of 10. I wasn't from a poor, I'm not claiming for a second I was from a poor upbringing, but I only flew twice between the time I was born and the age of 20, I think. Or was it once? I must have been on a plane. I'm not sure. Until the age of about 20, I think I'd been on a plane once or possibly twice. That was it in 20 years. I think people should be, to some extent, reasonably grateful for being born at this moment. And yet, if you, it's also worth noting, by the way, that of course, what young people lack is what I'd call kind of chronological context. In, let's say you're 20 and you've only really been a conscious adult for 7 or 8 years. There's a great phrase which is that bad news is fast and good news is slow. So most of the bad things that happen in the world kind of are an overnight news event. I mean, the invasion of Ukraine, whatever it may be, those bad things happen really, really fast. Progress in the world tends to be really boringly slow. So a lot of people, for example, think the incidence of extreme poverty in the world is getting worse. It isn't. The incidence of poverty in the world has been reducing progressively for something like, well, significantly for 30 years. But it's not a news story because it happens a little bit every day. By contrast, the shit that happens, whether it's an earthquake or or some sort of catastrophe or a school shooting, okay, that stuff's immediately newsworthy because it happens fast. And I'm always conscious of the fact that obviously, as a 58-year-old man, I'm conscious of what's better now than it was in 1972. And people, by the way, are a lot richer in a country like Australia or in the UK. You don't notice it because it's slow and there is still poverty. And to some extent, I would argue that the fact that there is still so much poverty is, rather tragic given the increase in overall wealth and well-being. And you could argue it's a scandal. But nonetheless, well, okay, something I tell other people my age will remember that, first of all, when I was young, just interesting factors. When I was young, you could tell how rich people were by their clothes to an extent. Now, obviously, you can do that in extreme cases now, in the case of vagrancy and so on. But basically, unless you choose to dress really, really bling and rich, you can't tell from the state or the fit of people's clothing. Whereas when I was young, the poorer kids in school had kind of ill-fitting hand-me-downs or clothes that were just dirty and they actually smelled. Okay, right? I mean, now that still that level of poverty still exists, but not at anything like the pervasive level than it would have done then, when it was just considered to be kind of universal. But I'm conscious of the fact that my children haven't been adults for long enough to actually to see much improve. Because, you know, I suppose, I mean, they don't even remember the internet coming up. You don't, do you, I expect? But, you know, when were you born, actually?
I was born in 99 and I remember dial-up, the
Yeah,
that's the.
that's it. Yeah, you can still remember dial-up, which I suppose would have persisted until about when would dial-up have ended? So if you're probably 2002. I remember I got ISDN in about 2001, 2002. I think I had ISDN, and then I would have got ADSL, and the end of dial-up effectively would have been about 2004, five, something like that.
Yeah, I think Australia's a bit behind. So I probably got ADSL 2+ maybe around when I was 12, 13, 14. So that would have been around 2010, 11, 12.
In fairness, though, Australia invented Wi-Fi, didn't you? And you've never, n nobody knows this.
I did not know that.
I'm pretty sure that it was a bunch of, got a vague idea, it was weirdly a bunch of Australian astronomers who were also involved in it. But I'm pretty sure that the kind of heavy maths duty, I'm fairly sure that Wi-Fi is kind of an Aussie invention. I mean, in as much as anything is uniquely the invention of one person anymore. But I'm fairly sure that actually it was a bunch of Australians who were instrumental in it. You have to do some sort of weird maths, which like, but it's a Fourier transform. I don't know what this means. But you know, some of the interesting maths behind making Wi-Fi work, I think went on. I got a vague idea. It was something to do with astronomers, and this may be me getting it completely wrong. I'll research it afterwards. But yes, I suppose Wi-Fi. So you had ADSL plus when you're about 11 or 12, and then a few years later it would have gone straight over to ADSL. Yeah.
And then we got like NBN fiber probably when I was around 18. So that's, I guess, 2017.
Got it.
Yeah. It was crazy.
Well, that's it. Yeah, now you can remember that. Now my own kids, born in 2001, they probably, because we got Yeah, they can't obviously remember a world without the internet, for example. And there are things which I still find a bit remarkable. I mean, the story I always tell, and apologies to people who've heard this before, is I was actually, funnily enough, at Sydney Airport on the tarmac waiting to fly back to London. And I just, you know, I still had my phone on because they hadn't told us to turn it off. And I briefly giggled, and my kids said, "What are you laughing at, Dad?" And I said, "Well, I've just for 30 seconds back there, I turned the heating on at home. I turned the central heating on at home." Now, bear in mind, it was summer in the UK at the time. I was there during the Australian winter, and it just amused me as someone born in 1965 that, and this was completely unanticipated by us in 1970. You know, in 19, I was born in 1965. And in the 1970s, this side of stuff was completely unanticipated by us, as weirdly, mobile telephony was largely unanticipated, by the way. But the fact that you could control your home's central heating from literally the other side of the world, and that I was sitting there on a plane in Sydney, and you know, 23,000 miles away, this boiler at home just clicked in, turned on for about a minute, and then turned off again. That seemed to be amazing. And my kids just looked at me and went, "Dad, you're such an idiot." And I said, "Oh, this is a bit abusive, but why am I such an idiot?" Then it suddenly occurred to me, they had never existed in a world where there was anything remarkable about being able to do that.
Talking about technology, I see you use a vape. Like, that's like a transition. Like, we went from cigarettes to vapes, and I have friends that are into it. There's coils, that it's oils, it's like a whole art to it, and it's only recent.
Australia actually is incredibly oppressive towards vaping, isn't it? You kind of banned. Am I right about this? Because the Australian vaping laws, although I don't think they're enforced, if I'm fair about it, is that right?
Yeah, I'm not too sure. I haven't followed along. I think it's highly frowned upon, but a lot of the youth use it. It's very common amongst the youth. It's sort of like cigarettes back in the day. That's how it feels like, where everyone was smoking a cigarette, everyone has a vape now.
And my view is I'm slightly instrumental in the UK's very, very hands-off liberal approach to vaping, because I argued that in behavioural terms, giving up smoking is very, very hard. And it's not only the chemical addiction, actually, it's all kinds of mental pathways where you're addicted to the behavior. So things like, to some extent, things like patches, which replicate the drug without replicating the behavior, the inhalation, don't really cut it for people who are long-time smokers in terms of a substitute behavior. And so I was convinced that actually the invention of e-cigarettes was a watershed moment in people quitting smoking and the extent to which people could successfully quit. And so I went to the government's behavioral insights team and happened to present these e-cigarettes and said, look, I know I can predict two things, one of which is that this will help people quit. Okay. And the second thing I'm going to predict psychologically is that everybody will try and ban them because the natural reaction of the health establishment is, ooh, it's new. Young people are doing it. We must ban this thing immediately. And it's complicated because actually, what we tend to do with drugs is we tend to do a cost analysis. But if we're being honest, Paul Dolan at the LSE taught me this. If we're being honest about drugs, we should do a cost-benefit analysis. Because, you know, I've never taken ecstasy, weirdly, given that I'm a bit too old. But they're obviously, okay, that drug has benefits as well as costs. You can't just say, all we're going to do is look at the negative side of the equation. What are the costs of this drug? And alcohol, I think, has very unevenly spread costs and benefits. But there are benefits to alcohol, undoubtedly, in terms of sociability and relaxation and everything else, and a whole drinks economy. There are benefits to it. There are benefits to nicotine, actually. There aren't many benefits to smoking tobacco. Well, there are benefits to it, but those are massively outweighed by the health disadvantages of the delivery mechanism. It's unusual in that sense, nicotine, by the way, in that most drugs, the adverse effects of most drugs are caused by the drug itself, whereas the adverse effects of nicotine are rather small. And some serious scientists argue that, in fact, it's a highly positive, nootropic substance. The nicotine itself, but the delivery device, which was inhaling burnt tobacco, because of the carcinogenic content to the smoke, and other factors as well, by the way, that's not the only problem, undoubtedly made smoking a kind of net negative ish, okay? But it becomes a bit more contentious when the delivery mechanism is safer, because there are benefits to nicotine, just as there are potential. I mean, they're now discovering, of course, benefits to certain either party drugs or hallucinogens in some cases. They're discovering that, you know, various hallucinogens can be hugely beneficial in terms of treating things like depression. I've heard cases where it's unbelievably powerful in treating sort of alcoholism, for instance. And they're also discovering that various party drugs may be actually very valuable in, you know, delivered in a medical professional context, can be very beneficial to treat certain things. So it's a completely false dichotomy. This is a typical kind of human mental foible to make a false dichotomy between pharmaceutical drugs and recreational drugs. Because it's quite likely that just as some pharmaceutical drugs end up having a recreational component, some recreational drugs will probably have a pharmaceutical component. That applies to cannabis for the treatment of various conditions, which quite often, by the way, in the elderly, interestingly, it also applies to nicotine, which has certain which may actually ward off dementia and seems to have certain benefits for people doing brain work of any kind. And it also seems to apply to, because I mean, the reason people take recreational drugs is to some extent they're medicating themselves.
I think I was hearing, I went, Andrew Huberman was in Sydney and he sort of talked about how he had a friend who was a Nobel Prize winner and he would chew nicotine all the time, like five, six gum a day type person. And he said apparently it helps reduce, there's strong studies that say that it helps reduce Alzheimer's and dementia and sort of Parkinson's.
I've heard various stories about that, about nicotine itself. The other thing is that it does seem to improve cognitive performance in some way. So I had one friend who's a very eminent biochemist. I won't name him because he'll get into trouble, but who said, you know, I got into his car at the airport in, he was at the University of Pennsylvania at the time. I got into his car and kind of apologized for vaping and said, well, most of the, I think, sorry about this, I'm still hooked, but I think most of the harm's in the delivery device, not in the nicotine. And the guy, who's a very serious biochemist, said, look, if you did an absolutely unbiased assessment of nicotine, you'd probably add it to the water supply. And I mean, there is an interesting aspect, which is they will always try and ban vaping because young people are doing it. But young people try everything. I'd much rather young people got hooked on vaping than they got hooked on smoking. But also, I'm going to say something which I don't think often gets said. And I had one of the most astute people working in advertising ever, a man called Paul Feldwick, said the same thing. He said, we give young people a really hard time if they smoke. But he said, if I look back on my teens and 20s, it's a difficult time of life. You don't know who you are. There's a huge amount of uncertainty. Your whole career, path is completely unclear. You may have a messed up romantic life. There's lots and lots of disruption at that stage in your life, which you don't have to contend with when you get a bit older. And he said, I would have found it really difficult to get through my 20s as a functioning adult without smoking, he said. Now, he was harkening back really to the sort of, I guess it would have been the late, very late 70s, early 80s. That would have been his period. He's a bit older than me. But when he said that, I said, yeah, I can't really envisage having got through university and, starting work and all that sort of thing without nicotine as a prop. It would have been difficult. And the other upside I take to that is I never really used alcohol as a prop. And if we're being fully honest about this, did I ever have, no, I there were periods in my life where I drank quite a lot, but I never had a drink problem, and I've never been really compelled to drink. I don't really have that thing where I go, I really, really need a drink, or when I get home and you crack open the bottle of wine in the fridge and then end up drinking most of it. I've never had that. And so now, would I have drunk a hell of a lot more if I hadn't been able to smoke? Don't know. It's impossible to say. I don't know the counterfactual. But these things, I mean, human life is immensely complex. And what we're always trying to do is tinker with the parts rather than understand the whole, I think.
One thing I've noticed is I naturally never had that urge to smoke or drink, but I had peers that did, and it was very correlated to our parents. Like my parents never drank, never smoked, and the friends that did drink and their parents drank, and it was very correlative.
Well, it's funny you mention that because I raised that on Twitter once. You get that scene in American films where the guy, something bad's happened. He's lost his girl. He's lost his job. Some shit's happened, and he goes to a bar and knocks back spirits, And my parents never did that either. And I wonder how much of that is actually as much a learned behavior as it is a natural human instinct. In other words, your point that it's correlated interests me because, having said that, I had one friend who was a major alcoholic whose parents didn't seem to drink very much at all. So there's obviously a genetic component to this and almost certainly an environmental social component. Some people, of course, are just very, very socially anxious. They find it very difficult to enjoy socialization while sober. So, it's worth noting that as well. But no, your point, I raised exactly that question you did, which is if you're exposed to people who get home and neck a bottle of wine, are you more likely just to do it yourself because you've consciously or unconsciously you've learned that that's how you respond to shitty circumstances? Now, my parents would drink socially. They drink to make a good occasion better. But I didn't really see my parents drink. Maybe my dad had the odd whiskey when it was really tough, but he didn't drink it in huge quantities or ostentatiously. And so it was just a behavior I probably never learned, really. And it is interesting because you'd see in Gen Z a huge decline in alcohol consumption. I mean, it's one of the few uncontestable generational trends is generally a fairly massive reduction in booze consumption. And what's driving that? Some of it may be a sort of, is it because our parents' generation were different, or is it because the younger generation is different? How much of this is learned and socially contextualized, and how much of it is individual is a really interesting question. I mean, some of it is other drugs, by the way. Okay. I mean, some of the hit to alcohol sales is undoubtedly driven by the much greater availability and much lower stigmatization of things like cannabis. Where when I was at university, if there was cannabis in the university, you would expect the police to get involved. Or, there was the chance that the police would get involved. Whereas my own children at university seem to regard cannabis as pretty much, just an alternative to alcohol or whatever. I mean, their peer group. I don't think that either of them was a massive stoner, to be honest. But it didn't have the same kind of stigma or kind of, oh gosh, illegal drugs thing. And there's a comedic sketch where the guy goes, what happened to, nicotine and cannabis? They kind of did a role reversal, that nicotine became more and more vilified when it was a universal thing in the, in the 80s. I was in an office where practically everybody in the office smoked. And the extent to which, tobacco has been stigmatized and cannabis has somehow, as he put it, it went to medical school. It got its act together. It turns itself around. Okay. That's definitely a kind of weird phenomenon of my lifetime, which I don't think I would have. There always was a kind of cannabis legalization or decriminalization movement in the UK, in fairness, but I don't think we seriously expected it to succeed to the extent it did.
When you sort of talked about everyone was smoking back in the days at the office, the instant thing I thought of was Mad Men. Like, was life like the TV show Mad Men, where everyone's in suits, everyone's smoking, everyone has slick back hair? You're talking about how to sell cigarettes when everyone's saying, was that what it looked like?
That was mostly Mad Men covers the era, let me get this right, from I think the 1950s to the early 70s, if I've got that right. I think it's about a 14 year, something like a 14 year period. I'm pretty sure it starts in the 50s and it ends up with the Coke ad, Hilltop, which was I think it's sort of 1973, 72, something like that. And, it's fascinating because, of course, it's a brilliant setting that period in an ad agency is 10 times more interesting and creatively richer than setting it in an accountancy firm in the same period, because you did see these immense social changes happening. And of course, by basing the whole thing in an ad agency, you ma now. When you talk to people in that area, it hugely depends on which agency you're in. And I spoke to people at Ogilvy who remember that period, Joel Raffleson, who unfortunately died last year, wonderful guy. And he always claims it was nothing like that, and his wife always says it was exactly like that. I mean, the drinking thing, I mean, by the way, that was it. That was not just advertising. That was actually endemic in American life in the 1950s. And to some extent, the 60s was unbelievably boozy and drink-ridden. I remember a friend of my wife's who accompanied her father on a business trip to New York. This is a friend of my wife's parents, just in case you're thinking, well, okay, in the 1950s. And she was given a martini after they'd finished work. Everybody was just handed martinis, okay? And she was handed a martini, and she remembers that it was a big, thick-stem martini glass with a huge, great, pyramidal thing. And they filled it to the top with booze, which is a martini is pretty much, a huge, great chunk of neat spirit. And when they dropped the olive in, she saw that the olive went right to the bottom of the stem, and the stem was also full of booze. So it was like a third of a pint of spirits. They gave it to her. She was a 16-year-old girl. She was accompanying her dad. She might have been 17. Okay. And this is like 5 o'clock. This is in the United States. And the American attitude to alcohol is always, I mean, you've had prohibition, obviously. They've always had this completely roller coaster kind of attitude to alcohol. Alcohol consumption in the US is kind of weird. It's very different to the UK or Australia, because a third of Americans basically do not drink at all. So a third of Americans are effectively teetotal. Not, I mean, some of them will be teetotal for life. Some of them might be recovering alcoholics or whatever, or people who just decided to quit. Then another third of Americans drink very, very little. You know, it's rather like sort of, you know, it's kind of a beer. When they say I'm going out for a beer, they have a beer. They go, that was nice, and then they go home. You know, whereas if you go out for a beer in Britain, still in my age group, it means quite a few beers. And then a third of Americans effectively do all the drinking for everybody else. And it also varies regionally and all manner of things. But the US is much more, I always say about the US, if you want to understand the US is much more religious than the UK or Australia. And that includes the atheists, by which I mean, you know, American atheists are more religious than Brits are. And everybody goes, what do you mean that atheists are religious? And I go, well, the kind of puritanical underpinnings of the US, you know, that it was basically founded by religious nutters. The story they always tell is, oh, they were fleeing religious persecution in England. That's not true. They were extreme Puritan nutters, and the Brits were actually delighted to see the back of them because they're a pain in the arse. And that was in 17th century Britain, right? Okay, these people are whack. Okay, right. And, you know, to some extent, they left for the United States because they wanted to create a more Puritan society than England. And that still follows through, even if people don't believe in God or aren't Christian. The extent of kind of extreme opinion and dogma is just higher in the US. It's always been the case, I think. I mean, David Ogilvy wrote about this in the 1950s and 60s, that far more Americans went to church. But I think the religiosity also extends to other areas where beliefs tend to be, they're more easily shocked. They're more, I mean, there are certain aspects of, for example, if you took the, you probably remember the Bud Light scandal with Dylan Mulvaney. Now, I don't know, I'm interested to know the Australian opinion on this because, you know, I know right-wing Brits, I know left-wing Brits, right? And, you know, fair. Nobody in Britain would get really, really angry about a brewery giving some beer to a trans woman. Okay. In fact, most Brits' reaction to Dylan Mulvaney was that she was pretty funny. Okay. And that there wasn't any kind of anger that this would somehow, you know, it's a beer company, right? It doesn't even, your children aren't even involved. They aren't even seeing the media, right? So everybody who sees Dylan with her Bud Light is presumably an 18-year-old or 21-year-old or whatever it is, you know, consenting adult. So there's no issue there. So, well, I'm genuine. I had, you know, reporters from the Daily Telegraph, which is historically Britain's kind of conservative newspaper. And the journalist from the Telegraph was going, I understand, you know, that Americans are hugely exercised about this, but as a Brit, I can't really work out why anybody's upset. Don't get me wrong, there are activities which I think people are rightly upset about in that controversy, but I couldn't understand. I'm generally just going, I just don't understand it. It's not controversial. And you realize that things like that often get Americans riled much more than they get Brits or Australians riled. And that's what I mean by saying, you know, Americans are more religious than the Brits, and that includes the atheists. You know, people even without any religious foundations will get disproportionately upset about certain things.
Interesting. What's your thoughts on this sort of this woke culture? It feels like, I don't know if it's just I'm skewed because of what I see on Twitter and social media, but it feels like there is this push for transgenders, pride flags, you know, the devil in music videos, sort of really trying to push gender equality as well as like making a black Little Mermaid. And I see like arguments on both sides. Like, who's pushing this? Is it a good thing? What's the reason behind all this?
I would argue that a good part of it is well-intentioned, or ostensibly well-intentioned, and you've got to be careful which is which. I would argue that a significant part of it is successful and important. So I'm not one of these people who goes, ooh, it's ridiculous. Okay. On the other hand, I think a part of it, in particular, the extreme dogma that emerges. So, you know, what J.K. Rowling says is, I'm not even sure I agree with J.K. Rowling, but I think it's perfectly reasonable that she should be able to say it without fear of kind of censor, cancellation, or, you know, being treated as some sort of deranged turf. Okay. It's a point of view, right? What I also find weird about it is that When you get people who are deeply, deeply upset by J.K. Rowling's latest pronouncement, say, I don't really mind if I'm sitting there watching the television and it is a trans person who goes, I find this deeply offensive because, okay, trans people can speak, okay, but it isn't. It's someone claiming to be offended on behalf of other people. Now, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing that some groups take care of others, but there's a bit of white savior complex in a lot of this. A lot of it, I think, the extreme dogma and unwillingness to accept that certain things are contextual. Right now, okay. So, who uses which lavatory, right? Or, okay, prisons. Okay, you know, who goes to which prison? Whether trans women can compete in women's sporting events, right? Okay. I would argue that, look, that comes into the realm of decisions where you kind of go, oh, it depends. All right. Now, you know, there are certain places where I suppose malign people who could simply identify as women without any surgery could take advantage of women's refuges, women's prisons, etc. You'd have to acknowledge that this has to be handled with, you know, contextual judgment. You can't make an absolutely dogmatic statement about this. In the same way that, you know, I know quite a few people, Deirdre McCloskey included, The Economist. Okay. And as far as I'm concerned, those people, you know, I treat those people in every respect as female. But if I were a medic having to operate, it would be, in that context, it would be completely wrong to say, well, we're just going to treat someone as though they are a woman. Okay. Because medically, it would, you know, that's a question, if you like, of sex rather than gender. Okay. And in that context, obviously, you don't maintain the absolute kind of adherence to that rule. Medical condition, it'd be completely in breach of all kinds of medical principles. So the unwillingness for people to go, yeah, as a general rule, this applies, but there might be contexts where it's a bit controversial. The unwillingness to accept the fact that, you know, most human judgment is contextually mediated, right? You know, there are an awful lot of problems which you can't solve through legislation, which you can just solve through day-to-day behavior. You know, generally, you know, the reason when I go into a shop, I'm not frightened of being assaulted or giving my money to the shopkeeper. You know, it's not only law that preserves those conditions, it's also social norms, conventions, reputation. There are a lot of evolutionary mechanisms that enable us to cooperate with each other. One of which, fairly reasonably, would seem to be the ability to cooperate with people who disagree with you about certain things. Now, what's quite interesting about this, okay, is that if you work in business, there are people, I know people tend to characterize business as being right wing, okay, in the way that they tend to characterize academia as being left wing, right? That would be a sort of generalization. In fact, in business, I included this very wealthy, successful business people. People run the whole gamut from pretty left-wing opinions to pretty right-wing opinions. You know, there are extreme kind of Chicago school, you know, kind of liberal economics people in the business world who want to privatize everything, but they're equally people who think that they themselves should pay more tax, and so on. And what I notice about business is at no point is it ever an issue. You know, in other words, right-wing people cooperate with left-wing people because they're trying to, you know, make money. In other words, they're motivated by some sort of profit. They may be motivated by some sort of higher purpose. You know, many kind of, I think, you know, many dot-com companies are motivated not only by greed, but by the urge to make a difference. But I've never come across a situation, okay, you know, let's take Ogilvy, where I was unable to work with somebody because we had political disagreements. Now, that would obviously apply if the person was like a absolute, you know, virulent sort of racist or Nazi or something. I'd say, you know, I find this problematic. But generally, people can cooperate across, just as if you go to a pub, the typical table of pub boozers will consist of a range of political opinion. And it doesn't prevent them drinking together or generally agreeing or sharing jokes or cracking gags. This idea of complete opinion purity, which is that you could, that somehow you become defiled if you're exposed to people with dissenting opinions, that strikes me as a pathology. That, you know, that strikes me as just fundamentally ridiculous. And the other thing that strikes me as a bit weird too is the extent, as I said, to which I'm very, very interested in hearing black opinion on the black experience, for example, what it's like to grow up in England with, in some cases, and England's by no means the worst country in which you could grow up under those circumstances, okay? But, forever surrounded by a vague sense of unease. It may not be that you have absolute. You've actually been a victim of violence, although you're possibly more likely to have been. But the fact that you feel, conscious, vague unease all the time. Now, that wouldn't occur to me necessarily. And so listening to people who had a different experience to mine is really, really valuable because it's always a really useful exercise trying to see things from other people's point of view. But at the same time, I find them, I want to hear more about that opinion. I want to hear more, I want to hear more trans voices on the news talking about what that is. But instead, what you get are these weird people who are kind of setting themselves up. They're sort of self-appointed saviors. And it annoys me because I think, the voices should go to the people themselves, not to a bunch of weirdo academics who've just decided to, invest their whole reputation in one or other a particularly extreme opinion. Now, again, I mean, I was talking to John Cleese about this, who's fairly active as an anti-woke spokesperson, and it's notable that even left of centre comedians, are more or less saying, look, if you're in danger of killing comedy here. And anyway, should comedy be judged? Should what is acceptable comedy be judged by really humourless people? Is a really, generally, okay, you want wine judged by people who know a lot about wine and food judged by people who know a lot about food, okay, or at least who have taste buds, okay. Now, what we're having is we're having comedy policed by people who basically don't have a sense of humor. And so I can understand why comedians find the woke thing extraordinarily stupid, because of course, the other thing is that as a comedian, quite often you're adopting a persona, you're not actually saying what you believe, I mean, I think Ricky Gervais does believe some of what he does, but some of it is an act. And so I understand why comedians, but John Cleese and I would agree that things like trigger warnings aren't a bad idea. There are various people who can be traumatized by particular forms of content, and therefore warning them in advance that some of that content might be in the Netflix film they're about to watch strikes me as a basic courtesy. There is one criticism of which I thought was interesting, which was I think there was an opera guy, an opera producer, who said, but the whole point of this thing is to surprise people. And therefore, if they know what's happening in advance, it ruins it. Well, my answer to that is I think you should make the trigger warnings. What I mean is you should make them optional, which is press your red button and we'll display what this film, if it contains nudity, swear. And I'm not remotely bothered about swearing. I'm not remotely bothered about nudity. There might be, elements of content which would, I'd find distressing. And so allowing people at the very least to have a preview of what the content contains, that strikes me as a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And so there are people on the right who get angry about absolutely everything. And that's just as ridiculous a position. And I've come to the conclusion that actually, once more than a certain percentage of your life becomes political, right, you go mad. I'm not even sure politics should be a full-time job. I'm not sure we wouldn't be better run if, it was done by either people who'd retired from doing something else, or it was done by at the weekends by people who had other jobs during the week. Because it seems to me evident that, at some point, when you're literally wake up in the morning and you see the world exclusively through a kind of left or right wing political lens, you start to go mad. And I've seen people in various sides of the, it could be everything from, trans debates and TERFs, etc. You can see people, and you probably notice the thing that when people retire from politics and they're interviewed on television, they suddenly become much saner, more reasonable people. We're optimizing the world around the need to win arguments rather than the need to solve problems. And that strikes me as very problematic. In other words, we're creating a kind of, in other words, political people are obsessed with winning an argument and point scoring. And it's not a good culture if you want to collaboratively and creatively solve problems. That kind of point scoring adversarial culture isn't what you want most of the time. I mean, sometimes it probably works. But actually, this is deeply problematic because I think people literally being, and I think it happened a bit to Jordan Peterson. Okay. He started off with, I think, a reasonable objection to making it a legal requirement in Canada to use certain terms, where he said there's no precedent. I wouldn't disagree with him on that. And I think that there was a phrase used of the right-wing British politician Enoch Powell, which is he was driven mad by the remorselessness of his own logic. And I think that's happened a little bit to Jordan Peterson. You've become so invested in one position that essentially you have this kind of reputational sunk cost where your entire reputation and sense of identity and self-worth effectively gets identified with a particular political position. And given human sensitivity to kind of status and reputation, I think that when that happens, you go mad. And I think you should always make the point, whatever your politics are, you should actually make the point of saying, actually, I lean right of centre, but I'm pretty left wing about this. By the way, most people are like that. Okay, most people don't ascribe to a kind of, and someone described this as the footballization of politics, that people have started to support political positions the way other people support football teams, and it's not a good thing, because it's absolutely, in some ways, the antithesis of independent thought.
Interesting. Rory, as a father, sort of having kids in the early 20s, like, how do you sort of, well, what's your thoughts? Because, like, as a person in my early 20s, I'm growing up in this dopamine infested world, and we go back to, you know, drinks, people are drinking less, and maybe that's a result of the phone is a drug. It's like, even as disciplined as I am, I'm having to delete apps because I know I'm not, it's just impossible. It's like cocaine.
One thing that helps when you get older is your eyesight isn't quite as good. And your phone becomes slightly annoying because there are loads of things you can't quite read without spectacles. Okay. I would personally, I think, okay, this is an interesting debate, okay, which is the form factor of the phone. Would we all be better off if we had effectively a feature phone that did? Now, what happens when Samsung produces a folding tablet? Okay. Is the answer really we need a phone which is where we can simply have, you know, now, okay, you need, what are the things you actually need when you leave the house? Well, the Uber app might be one of them, okay? You need to be able to send and receive texts. You need to be able to make and receive calls. And my favoured solution to that would be, in 5 years' time, assuming that Samsung produces, you know, a relatively slightly, either a smaller tablet that unfolds to become a normal tablet, or a normal tablet that unfolds to become an enormous tablet, okay? My ideal solution would be to have a phone that only does those things which are kind of mission critical, that we carry around with us. You could even create a new operating system for this, I suppose, okay? But you literally have a phone which just does things which are, you know, in emergencies I can be reached, because you have to carry a phone, because there are about five or six applications. Parking would be another one, parking apps, where if you don't, you know, payment increasingly is becoming phone based, but where actually all the other shit, you know, the social media shit and the distracting shit is not present on that phone. And then you have a tablet which at given moments you unfold, turn on, interact, close down. I must admit, that's largely what I do, because I carry a computer to work every day. I also carry a tablet to work every day. It just doesn't add much weight once you've got to have the large bag. And I don't use my phone much for anything, discretionary, you know, social media, anything like that. The tablet has the advantage that you're either using it or you're not. And it requires an effort. Now, on a train journey, I get out the tablet, or on a plane on Wednesday, you know, 4-hour flight, I come back and I watch a film on the tablet, or I do the crossword, or read the newspaper, or whatever it might be. But then I put it away and I'm not using it. And I think there is, I hope Because I don't think we'll solve this problem until we change the form factor to some extent of mobile devices. Because I find it weird that my kids will, watch films on a phone or read books on a phone. I don't do that. Now, maybe because I'm a 58-year-old bloke and my eyesight's shit. Okay. But I find that, I think it's partly to do with my cohort, my age group. I find that just kind of fucking weird. I mean, okay, when I was a kid, everybody wanted a bigger television. Okay, right, oh, he's only got a 28-inch TV. Oh, it's black and white, right? And now suddenly you can have 55-inch, 85-inch bloody televisions, and there are these kids sitting there watching some film on a crappy little letterbox size thing. Why are you doing that? I don't, I genuinely, it's genuinely weird. And so I had that problem, I think, with constant interruptions and being constantly on call and never being able to switch off. And to some extent, I think I solved it by basically I used my phone for the things where, I would go out. If I went out with my wife for dinner, okay, I would take a phone, obviously, because you kind of have to, but I wouldn't take the tablet. And I deliberately not take the tablet. And generally, I haven't gone to the extreme of deleting everything from my phone. If this were a problem with me, I think that's what I'd do. Because I think it's just, little, if you want to leave the tablet in the car when you go to dinner, and then don't use your phone for dicky things like social media, I would say. I still use the web mostly. I'm sitting here, I'm looking at you on a 55-inch 4K TV, which I also use as a monitor. It's on the wall of the room I'm sitting in. Why would I do that in a shitty little screen? It doesn't make sense, but go figure. Weird.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. Like, I'm trying to put myself in your kids' shoes and see why I sort of use my phone. And I think it's weird. Like, when I was young, it was always you want to get bigger TVs, but then somehow I've sort of progressed and I love watching my phone while lying down on the couch or my bed and being able to sort of be lazy or, I'm in my sleeping clothes and I have the TV out in the living room. So I want to be in bed cozy while watching this phone next to me. But then it's weird when I'm eating, I guess, lunch or dinner, it's sometimes easier just to open up YouTube on my phone versus walk up, grab the remote, turn on the TV, bring the food, sit on the couch, sit, and then now I'm also having to look up and down, looking up and down. And I guess, yeah, those I guess are the main reasons, but I totally understand where you're coming from. Yeah.
But one of my great indulgences, one of the greatest things I've done in the last few years, which I recommend to everybody, is YouTube Premium, which is in many ways the hardest of the streaming services to buy, because of course you can have the whole of YouTube for free. That doesn't apply to Netflix, doesn't apply to Amazon Prime Video, doesn't apply to, Paramount or whoever. And so it feels particularly ridiculous paying what is about £15 a month for YouTube Premium, which is ad-free YouTube. But when you have a smart TV, when you effectively have, internet connected TV with YouTube, Prime, Netflix, you watch an unbelievable amount of Netflix. And you don't always watch it, by the way. So I watch a lot of podcasts. Sorry, you watch an unbelievable amount of YouTube. And when I say watch it, that also includes most of my podcasts I watch on YouTube. And when I say watch, I listen to them quite often while I'm reading or getting on with something else, but it happens to be on TV. And I use YouTube as my kind of go-to. It's probably the default thing, whereas it used to be you turned on your television and the default was it connected to the cable box and you connected to live TV. One of the most significant behavioral changes is the change in the design of the choice architecture of TVs and TV remote controls. So if you've got a Samsung TV, it used to default to BBC One. Okay, and in Australia, I imagine it would be the main ABC channel was the channel that came on when you turned on the TV, and you had to make a conscious effort to go somewhere else. What's happened now is you turn on a Samsung TV, and when you press the button with the little house on it, okay, what it takes you to, the default position is, do you want to watch YouTube? Do you want to watch Sky? Do you want to watch Netflix? Do you want to watch this? And I find first of all, when you have ad-free YouTube, it becomes unbelievably useful because, as I said, YouTube hit this tipping point where it's now become Wikipedia with video. It used to be interesting, but it wasn't really searchable. It's now reached a volume of content, and I don't know when we reach that tipping point, where if you have a weird, obscure IT problem, if you need to, actually doesn't really happen in Australia much, but if your boiler outflow freezes and you need to repair that, okay, you can search and there'll be someone who's made a film about it. I think that's just extraordinary. I think it's just amazing. The extent to which you can search for really, really, I discovered, I'm very interested in advertising, and for 50 years, well, I wasn't really in advertising when I was five, okay, but for 30 years of my life, I'd never seen any film footage of Bill Birnbach. I vaguely knew what he looked like from photographs, and I discovered on YouTube there are a couple of TV interviews with Bill Birnbach. What the fuck? Okay, and who's this guy who posted that? What a hero, right? You had that content in your possession. Well, most of us, selfish bastard that I am, would have gone, oh, I'm glad I've got that. I'll store it on my PC. And these people go to the bother of uploading it and, doing all that sort of thing. And, the people who post, film clips, the people who post, documentary footage, the people who post, kind of archive footage. I mean, those people are fucking heroes, right? It's just an act of glorious, selfless generosity. And so the extent to which now YouTube is searchable, we need to learn to use it differently, because it is now, as I said, Wikipedia with pictures. If there's a topic you're interested in, there's more than enough content on it. And when you pay the extra for YouTube Premium without the interruptions, that particular application of YouTube becomes five times more, more applicable, more valuable. One of the things I try and do is, I watch television when I'm watching. One of the problems of the mobile phone, right, is that when I started work in 1988, where you were determined what you did, right? If you're in a meeting room, you're in a meeting. If you're in a photocopier room, you were photocopying. If you're at your desk, you were doing desk-like things, right? If you're on the phone, you were on the phone making a phone call, right? So where you were and the equipment you were using focused you on a particular thing, because there was only one thing you could do in the photocopy. Well, I suppose there were nefarious things you could do in the photocopy room, but basically you photocopied. That's what it was there for. That's why you were there, and that's what you did. And the phone, by being this annoyingly portable universal device, has kind of created continuous distraction. And that's not the worst problem. The worst problem, if you read the work of people like Jonathan Haidt, is the unbelievably deleterious effect that social media has, particularly, it appears, on young and teen girls. This is Haidt's research. You might argue that, I mean, gaming isn't particularly male anymore. It used to be, but it's not, but you might argue that, to some extent, if you're not a gamer and you females seem to be more fixated by social media. I mean, we notice this. Is this social pressure? Is it genetic? Who knows? But, my wife feels awkward going to a restaurant without putting makeup on, So there is some element in which women are either trained or born to be more conscious of questions of appearance, right? And also perhaps more. There seems to be a slight rule for blokes, which is as long as you're really good at one thing, you can be shit at everything else, right? Okay, no man is embarrassed if he can't cook, right? No, as long the basic bloke strategy seems to be really good at one thing and then what the hell, okay? And so that imposes far less pressure on other parts of your life where you're not trying to be really good. Obviously, if you're a great cricketer, you've got to be good at cricket, but then you're allowed to, do a bit of a Shane Warne in the rest of your life. It does seem to me that in other words, the constant exposure to what feels like a form of judgment, and the exposure to completely unrealistic, curated views of other people's lives, okay, does seem to have really deleterious effects. Now, by the way, I don't know how to react to this, because my children, my daughters, I think they both got through it okay. I don't know why. One of them was hypersocial and so was always going out and meeting people anyway, and would rather meet people in the real world and had a great friendship group. The other daughter was nerdier, but she was more likely to be reading kind of Tumblr or reading nerdy articles on stuff than obsessing about what her friends were posting about. And neither of them tipped over in their teens. They're now in their 20s, in their early 20s. Neither of them, I think, tipped over into any kind of dangerous social media, either addiction or anxiety. But I think a lot of things are like alcohol. What I always say about alcohol is that tobacco and alcohol are slightly different, okay? Because smoking is quite bad for quite a lot of people who smoke. I mean, some people, my dad still smokes at the age of 93. Some people get away with it, but generally most people who smoke will probably end up having adverse life consequences from it at some point. But equally, not many of them die at 28. That's motorcycling, that's mountaineering, okay? That's base jumping, or it's alcohol, actually, not 28, but all of the people I know my age who are already dead, it's basically alcohol, 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 motorcycle, mountaineering. And my point is that I think social media is a bit like alcohol in that it's beneficial or neutral to a lot of people. But unlike tobacco, which is quite bad to quite a few people, I think alcohol is catastrophically bad to fewer people. There are people who drink with no problems at all, who enjoy drink. Winston Churchill always said, I get more out of drink than drink got out of me. I've taken more out of drink than drink's taken out of me. There are people who basically have a relationship with it, which is beneficial. But if you have really, really serious alcohol problems, that's catastrophic in a way that I mean, you may end up dead very, very young. You may end up totally unable to function. You may end up falling out with your family. You may end up killing someone in a road accident. The consequences of really bad alcohol use are in a way much wider socially than the consequences of tobacco use, which tend to be confined largely to the individual who practices the habit. And in defense of smoking, okay, yeah, if you die at 68, it's a bummer, but if you die at 28, it's a tragedy, right? It's a different order of magnitude as well.
Pretty cool how you sort of summed it around back to how the next generation is drinking less and how that's a benefit. So it's pretty cool how you were able to loop the whole thing back. I saw you did that. That was really cool. What's your thoughts on AI? And you talked about sort of obscured, tailored videos. Like eventually I'd be able to go to like an AI and be like, as a 24-year-old Vietnamese Australian, I weigh 70 kilos. What's the best treatment for my eczema? Like it could go that obscure, right?
It could, and you could get video content produced around that, which would be interesting. My initial fear with AI is interesting, which is there's the undoubtedly it has possibilities. All right. You'd be insane. However, there are various threats which we ought to be alert to. One of which is, of course, its ability to produce things that are just to hallucinate and produce things that are fundamentally wrong. The second thing is that how you train it affects it. All right. Now, if one particular AI predominates in the world, that's problematic. Much more problematic than just having one Google, if you like. Okay. I mean, having one Google, I think, is problematic. But at least Google does, there is that fundamental fear that, is this going to be kind of let a thousand flowers bloom with AI, or are we going to end up with the same problem we had with tech behemoths? Basically, the winner takes all effect. Then there's the problem of it acquiring superintelligence and destroying the world. Well, other people can worry about that because it's not my area of expertise. One thing that would worry me is that AI isn't very good, but it's imposed on people anyway because it's cheaper than humans. And that's a real fear, which is that quite a lot of things. Funnily enough, live chat is very good online, okay? But the number of times where you ring up a telephone line because you've been unable to find the answer from the company on the internet, and the first 30 seconds are saying, you can go to our website. I've just been on your fucking website for bloody well half an hour. And the reason I'm phoning you is because I couldn't find the answer on the goddamn website. Now, they're desperate for you to solve the problem on the website because a call center costs money and a website doesn't. Now, in the same way, okay, what you're going to see is customer service is going to be driven towards AI before it's ready and up to the task simply to save money. And then you end up with dealing with a machine, which is possibly incapable of kind of recontextualizing its thoughts, if you like, or of or of common sense, actually, which is, I see what you mean. What has happened is ridiculous. Let me solve this problem for you. I don't know how, but I'm going to find a way, which is what a human might do. And instead, just going, computer says no. There's a comedy sketch in the UK where, the computer says no, and where you end up literally living in a digitized bureaucracy because it's cheap. And that strikes me as the more, the more immediate pressing thing to be frightened of. I'm also bothered about it because what we have seen, too much innovation capital has been invested in tech, okay? As a proportion of how we can improve human life, right? Silicon Valley has received far too much of the kind of venture capital and early stage funding, and too much innovation investment. I mean, it's not that we've stopped investing in drugs. I'm not, but there are loads and loads of other ways you can innovate which are not primarily technological. So one thing that worries me is that AI will just receive too much money in relation to other things, because what seems to happen is the investment community has massive herd effects. And the other thing is that I think we're also ignoring really, really important technologies which are older, less novel, but nonetheless hugely important, of which one of them is what we're doing now, which is Zoom. Okay, so video conferencing, I believe, is actually of immense economic importance. I think it's of immense importance in terms of changing the nature of human discourse by effectively no longer requiring people to be co-located in order to have reasonably high quality conversations, of which I hope this is one, lasting around about an hour and a bit. Okay. And one of the things that I will have to go in 4 minutes, just to warn you, because I've got another call. One of the things that worries me is I think we should be. So my own employer is investing millions in AI. They're, every single conference is the role of AI in advertising and marketing and synthetic market research and all these various interesting areas. Okay. And I'm going, why aren't we having a conversation about how we reinvent our business around Zoom? Because, maybe our staff can go and live in Ibiza. Okay. Maybe their lifestyle benefits. Maybe, a whole team in London could actually work with a client in Los Angeles in a way that wouldn't have been possible pre-pandemic, not because the technology didn't exist, but because the behavior hadn't yet been normalized. If you think about it, the whole podcasting industry enjoyed this massive fillip during the pandemic, because suddenly, if you wanted to interview someone on a podcast, you didn't have to spend half an hour training them in the use of the technology because they'd been forced to learn it. And actually, the behavioral change is the really important part of innovation. It's not the technology, it's the extent to which the technology. I think Stuart Butterfield, the founder of Slack, said this. There's no meaningful measure of innovation other than behavioral change. If we're not changing how people behave, we're not really meaningfully innovating. And the really significant thing was, we'd had Skype. You probably grew up with Skype in 1998 or something. It arrived. It was very, very early. It's a bit shit. And it also used the model of the phone call, not the model of the meeting room, which made it fundamentally flawed, I think, psychologically. I think that was a fundamental failing. But I remember Zoom came along in about 2017, 2000, well, a bit earlier than that. But Ogilvy took out a Zoom account for everybody. And I thought, well, this is actually now seriously good. Like, we've had this conversation. You're in Sydney, I'm in London, about as far away as you can feasibly be. And we haven't had a single glitch, right? And we didn't expect a glitch. That's the really important part. We're not on Skype. You're always on tenterhooks going, this is going to freeze any moment. And Zoom got the technology right, and it got the user interface right, and it got the architecture right. But it also effectively then the pandemic meant that you were no longer had that problem where every video call was hostage to the worst technologist in the meeting. The person who arrived late, the person who couldn't make their microphone work, the person whose webcam was, covered in shit, whatever it might have been. But there was always that one person in a meeting of five people who, basically screwed it up. And the pandemic, by raising the floor of people's competence, solved that problem. I mean, there were Zoom calls with, people aged 80. Effectively, you can now reasonably assume, and it also normalized the use of the technology. So it no longer felt weird. if you're a business person, you said, let's meet on Zoom, it didn't feel like I can't be bothered to come and see you. It actually felt like a normalized, sort of sensible business decision. And so this strikes me as having absolutely huge implications for what happens in the world, with considerable economic benefits and not much downside. And yet nobody's focused on this at all. Now, I'm not saying AI isn't more important than video conferencing, but I'm saying that the ratio might be 2.5 to 1. And instead, we're making the ratio of attention and investment like 500 to 1. I'm still disappointed there aren't nearly enough video conferencing hardware devices being produced. You know, what, is there equivalent of Google Glass for video conferencing where wherever I am, I can just sit down and do, you know, that's what I really want. Okay. You know, I was in London yesterday. I had to go into a restaurant and kind of asked to use a table to do a video call with someone in Las Vegas. Okay. We haven't cracked the hardware side completely of video conferencing. There's some good devices coming out. But it strikes me that I'm not saying X is right and Y is wrong. I'm saying what's partly the problem of human life at the moment is the disproportion. You'd think, okay, you'd think in an always-on multimedia world that human attention would kind of dissipate and spread. And we now get to the question of mimesis and that guy, Pierre, whatever his name was, at Stanford, where we as humans, do we just watch what everybody else is watching? Because you have this absurd concentration of attention and energy on one or two very, very narrow topics to the exclusion of everything else. And you know, it's not what you would have predicted, okay, from the technological improvement we've seen in connectivity over the last 20 years. But the fact that, you know, you'd think this will be a thousand flowers bloom, this will be a diverse and varied world full of all kinds of exciting discussions. But to some large part, it's absolutely the opposite. It's everybody getting obsessed about the same thing because everybody else is obsessed by it.
It's crazy. I can go on forever, Roy. I had so many questions that I wanted to
Don't
hear.
worry, don't worry. We can do a follow-up if you want. I
I'd
have to
love
dash
a follow-up.
now because I've got to go interview. I'm sorry to have to dash now because I've only got 3 minutes.
All
I need
right.
to go to the loo before my next meeting. But this has been fantastic. Thank you very
Thank you very much,
much.
Roy. I really appreciate your time. Have a beautiful day.
All the best. You too. Bye-bye.
All right. So that was an episode of the podcast. That was pretty interesting. Yeah, the hour and a half flew by. I had so many questions I wanted to hit that I couldn't hit. But that's okay. I definitely want to do a follow-up with Rory. Yeah, very insightful conversation. Hope you guys got some value. Please let me know your thoughts. And I'll see you guys next week on another episode of the podcast. Peace.